In step 9, we saw two barren women who share one child, Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi. They're without husbands, they're without children, and God, in a wonderful way, brings Boaz into their life, and they both have a baby. Ruth has the child, and Obed is adopted by his mom-in-law, and it's a wonderful scene. We now move to step 10, when God's going to take another step in moving towards a great nation. In the little book of Ruth, we saw God working in a wicked and perverse society which was dominated by idolatry and immorality, and we see him at work through a godly remnant to bring a king. And in step 10, well, step 10 begins, I know this will seem strange to you and really different, a man and his barren wife are about to have a baby. The man was Elkanah from the hills of Ephraim, and his wife was Peninnah, and then he had another who had lots of children, and he had another wife, Hannah. Now, this is no time to discuss the multiple wives, but that's the situation. And he loved Hannah. It was a lot like the situation with Jacob, who loved Rachel, but it was Leah having the children. The heart of Elkanah went out to his wife, Hannah, in the fact that she had no child. But she started praying to the Lord, and she prayed fervently. And she said, Lord, give me a child, and I will give him to you. Well, she goes down in their annual trip down to the tabernacle. And she starts praying with such fervency before God, because she really wants this to happen. And there's an emotional thing in this prayer. And Eli, the judge, is watching her. And he calls her and said, look, go do your drinking at home. We don't want any drunk women around here. Well, the question is, why was he so quick to assume that Hannah was drunk? Well, consider the times. Gross idolatry, gross immorality. I mean, he was used to people coming around to the temple who weren't walking with the Lord. And then consider the contrast between his sons and Hannah. His sons were Hophni and Phinehas, who themselves are supposed to be judges of the people. And they're the priests. And they despised the sacrifice of the Lord. That is, people brought sacrifices to the Lord. And they simply walked off with them. You know, it's kind of people who go into the ministry supposedly to do good and end up doing very well. You know, they just milk instead of what belongs to God, they appropriate for themselves. And Hophni and Phinehas, now we saw gross idolatry and gross immorality. Now here's another grossness. These are the religious leaders, and they're stealing from God at the tabernacle. And not only that, gross immorality, they're having sex with the women who come to worship at the tabernacle. This is a frightful situation. Now, let's not ever make the excuse, well, they were men. You know, men will be men. No, no. Let's remember people like Boaz. Men and women are both to walk righteously before God. And this was a mess. And so when you have sons who despise the sacrifice and have sex with the women, and you're afraid to correct them, and you're in this culture that's falling apart, and you see this woman staggering around, she's drunk. She wasn't drunk. In 1 Samuel chapter 2, we get a close look at Hannah's heart when we hear her prayer. My heart exalts in the Lord, she says. My heart exalts in the Lord. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one besides thee, nor is there any rock like our God. Now this woman understands. Eli, Hophni, Phinehas, they ought to know. They don't know. She knows. Nor is there any rock like our God. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down and he raises up. He makes rich and poor. And she talks about his sovereignty. God is sovereign. He brings and raises and lifts. And she uses all this terminology. God, Well, that's language we understand. God does it. He's the one. God says, I will, and then he does it. He brings, he raises, he lifts, he keeps. For not by might shall man prevail. He will, the Lord, will give strength to his king. Does Hannah know something that nobody else knows? Because there was no king in the land. Everybody did that which was right in his own eyes. What does she know? He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. And then she talks specifically about her situation in that song. She talks about that child. If the Lord will give me a child, I will give him to the Lord. I have poured out my soul before the Lord, that he, the child, may appear before the Lord and stay forever. She really wants to exalt God. That's why her motives for having a child are wonderful. She wants that child to be God's servant. And she and Elkanah have a child. A barren woman and her husband have a baby. And though the child was young, she kept their promise. Oh, how easy it would have been to say, well, I really want to keep him at home. Oh, I love him. But she has made a promise. He belongs to the Lord. And so when he's young, she brings him to the house of the Lord. And she says, I've dedicated him to the Lord as long as he lives. And his mother Hannah would make a robe each year and come and give him a new robe every year, I guess, or maybe on his birthday. And in chapter 2, we learn that after she'd given that son to the Lord opened up her womb further, and she had 3 sons and 2 daughters. Well, she had never asked for that. That was not part of the bargain, but God blessed her in that. So there's this terrific contrast between Eli and his sons and this woman, Hannah. And then consider the contrast between Eli's sons and Samuel. Eli's sons, my sons, the report is not good which I hear. And his sons brought a curse to the people and to the land, and Eli would not rebuke them. Remember, they were despising the sacrifice and lying with the women. But Samuel, the boy Samuel, grew in stature and in favor with God and man. The Lord said, I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who'll do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house. And he's talking maybe prophetically, but also about Samuel. Now catch Samuel's situation. As a young baby, he goes to this boarding school where the headmaster is out of touch with God and has 2 sons who are awful, horrible people. Sinful people. Here he is at this Christian boarding school, and the headmaster's kids are the worst examples in the whole place. Some of you know that I was headmaster of a boarding school for 12 years, and often in the first day of school, about every 4 years when you have a new crop of people and new parents come, I'd speak on Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. And that even in that boarding school where they weren't interested in the Lord, Samuel was able to grow in the Lord. And his mama kept touch. He came every year with that new suit of clothes. And then something really interesting happened. Samuel was sleeping one night and he heard, Samuel, Samuel. So he got up and ran in and said, yes, Eli. Eli said, I didn't call you. Go back to bed. Samuel, Samuel. Samuel runs in. Yes, sir. I didn't call you. Go back to sleep. Third time. Samuel, Samuel. Samuel goes, Eli, did you call? And Eli, you know, it could be the Lord. Just could be, not probably, because we're told that the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Rare. We have no clear indication of God speaking since Moses. You know, you go back through Joshua and Judges. Where do we have a clear, direct revelation from God? You really have to go back to Moses. And it's been hundreds of years maybe since there's been a clear word from the Lord. But Eli says, well, when you hear that voice again, you say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And again the voice came, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." And God begins to bless the people by speaking through Samuel. Well, before we get to Samuel, we have to finish some old business. There's Eli and Hophni and Phinehas. Eli is very old. He's 98 years old. He's a big, heavy fella. He's nearly blind. It's a sad picture of this man. And his sons are out with the army because they've gotten involved in a skirmish, a battle with the Philistines. But they're not worried about the Philistines because they're going to take the ark with them. The ark from the tabernacle. And they're going to, that'll make them safe. It's sort of like having, you know, a little religious statue in your car and you can drive any way you want, or a little religious medal around your neck, or, oh, I wear a little cross so I'm okay and I can do anything I want. They thought that if they just took the ark out there, they could continue to live the way they wanted. And here were their priests. Who were their priests? These thieves and adulterers and fornicators were their priests. And they got out and they got beaten badly by the Philistines, who simply took the ark. And out of the battle came this scarred guy coming tired and dirty and sweating. He comes up and there is big old Eli, 98 years old, can't see very well, sitting on a chair. And he hears this man coming. He says, "What's the word?" And they said, "The Philistines have taken the ark and your sons are dead." And he falls over backwards and dies. Wow, what a scene. But there's no Eli, there's no Hophni, and there's no Phinehas, but there is a Samuel, and God is speaking to Samuel. And Samuel steps into the void as a young man. And we read that Samuel judged all Israel all the days of his life. Now, I want you to understand the significance of this. Samuel judged all Israel. We are now talking about a united country. We are not talking about Samuel judged each of the tribes. There's beginning to be a sense of unity under this man of God. He judged all Israel. And do you remember those judges? They were local, occasional, and temporary. But Samuel comes in as a young man, and he judges all Israel all the days of his life. He's going to take that shattered confederacy, that confederacy which had so lost touch with God and with His Word, and he's going to bring it back together. Some wonderful things happen. The Lord was with him, and let none of His words fail. And he judged all Israel from Dan up in the north, where they'd set up that idol. You remember the Danites? From Dan up in the north down to Beersheba in the south. Thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel. "Gather all Israel," and Samuel judged the sons of Israel. The sons of Israel, not this tribe, not that tribe, not the other tribe, but over and over, new terminology here in the book of Samuel. He judged the sons of Israel. There is a unification process. He cried to the Lord for Israel. He prayed for them. And there was a reform. There was a revival movement. He talked to them about their idols and about the little sacred places that they'd set up to worship these false gods. He scolded them about them, these things, and told them they had to get rid of it. He got them to confess their sin and to fast and pray and seek God. There is the beginning of a reform movement, a revival movement. And he points out to them that they can't just take some religious thing like the ark, even though it's God-given, and think they're going to wheel it into battle and win. He says to them, you got to get back to reality of your relationship with God. You got to move from your religion being some kind of thing that you wave at people to a relationship with God where you act as God's people. And it's certainly not a perfect revival and reform. But for the first time in 400 years, we are beginning to see things coming back together. He raises up a stone. Ebenezer, the name of the stone. You remember Ebenezer? It's a stone of help. When they get the tabernacle and they go out and, the ark, and they bring the ark back, they put up a big stone, and it is the stone of help. The Lord has helped us. Isn't that virtually the theme of this course? God's doing it, and He works through people. There's a revival, there's a reform, there's a change. It's just the beginning. There's a lot of things that have to be taken care of. But we read in 1 Samuel 7, "Now Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he annually went in a circuit all around the country." Do you remember our graphic of this, the period of the judges? The judges were local and temporary and isolated. But he is going to rule all Israel, judge all Israel all the days of his life. Well, the question is, how do we get from Samuel to the monarchy? Well, Samuel was unique among the judges because he ruled all Israel all the days of his life, where the other judges were local and occasional and temporary. And he had authority, and he wielded that authority in the name of God because God was speaking through him. The other judges lost whatever authority they had once the crisis was over. They were called up to deal with the crisis. And then we begin to see a transition from Samuel to a king. You see, there was no satisfactory successor for Samuel. He was a godly man who had judged all Israel all the days of his life. But when he was old, the people gathered together and wanted to talk to him. They say, "Samuel, you're getting old," although he was around for quite a bit longer. They said, "You're getting old and your sons do not walk in your way. And we want you to appoint a king for us. Give us a king. We want a king. We want a king." Well, much earlier, God had anticipated this. If you look back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, the idea for the king it has been around a long time. "When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you say, 'I will set a king over me like all the nations around me,' you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses." So the idea of a king in itself is not wrong. Unfortunately, the kind of king the people wanted was not the kind God wanted. They had said, "Appoint a king for us," just as Deuteronomy had prophesied. "Appoint a king for us, not for the Lord, for us, to judge us like the nations." They wanted a king like the kings that the nations have. Boy, if we had a king, that would save our problem. That would solve our problems. Well, you know, Samuel had united the people, helped them win military victories, brought them back before the Lord, was getting the society gathered together, and there they want more. They want more. "Point a king for us to judge us like the nations." Samuel had led the people under God's control, but the people wanted a king like those of the other nations, such as Nahash, the Ammonite. Nahash was apparently a big, able guy. "Nahash, king of the Ammonites." That's the kind of king we want. God's choice was a theocracy. He wanted to work, whether it was through a judge or whether it was through a king. God wanted to be their king. He wanted to speak. The word of God was spoken through the judge. But the people's choice was a monarchy where this king would, well, like all the other nations have. See, there's this great temptation to have some human being who will take care of us. You know, why doesn't the government do something? "I hate high taxes, but I wish the government would get out here and pave this road." You know, why doesn't the government? "Why doesn't the government? I hate high taxes. Why do they tax us to death? I want the government." We look for human leadership to solve our problems. We often have messianic type political figures. If people make enough promises, people believe it. Well, you know, over the years, God has done His work through different kinds of men, prophets, priests, judges. They seem to be getting more specialized at this time. There is no reason why God couldn't work through a king. That was not the problem. It was that Israel was the only nation on the face of the earth, but God was offering a theocracy, and they wanted something else. They wanted a king like the nations. Well, is God going to give them that? What's He going to give them? we'll see in a moment, but oh, Samuel was displeased. Oh, Lord, because he felt rejected. We want a king like the nations. I don't want this judge situation. And the Lord says, it's not you they've rejected, Samuel, but they've rejected me. They have rejected me as king because they want a king like the nations. So Samuel has this nice little speech and he warns them what it's like to have a king like the nations. He says, the king you get, when you get a king in, he is going to take, and read the word tax, taxation. He's going to take your sons and your daughters. He's going to take them in with and on his chariots. And they are going to be used for plowing his land and for making weapons. And he's going to need perfumers and cooks and bakers. And it's your sons and daughters. And then he's going to need from you feed and seed and fields and servants and donkeys and flocks. So he's going to keep taking and taking. And he's going to want you yourselves to be his servants. You understand the kind of bondage that you're about to step into? Samuel hadn't asked for all that. He hadn't had been so demanding. But the people said, there shall be a king over us to judge us and go out before us and fight our battles, that we also may be like the nations to fight our battles. Who fought their battles? Ebenezer. Who does it? God does it. And so they've shifted their hope from the Lord to a king. The Lord's reply to Samuel, appoint them the king. Appoint them a king. I wonder what kind of king it's going to be. Because Deuteronomy says that when they come into the land, that God is going to choose the king. They want a king like the nations. Are they going to get a king like the nations? Who is it? Who is it? I wonder if there's a barren woman out there about to have a baby. We're about to move to another step. Now think of where we've gone. We started with a promise to Abraham, one man, and then Isaac, and then Jacob, and we only had three men over three generations, God laying a foundation of men who believe God. And then we have the growing family, the clans, the Rachel and Leah build the house of Israel. And then you'll remember that the 11th son went down into Egypt, prepared the way. Israel went down there, and there they multiplied. You remember all that problem with Planned Parenthood? They just multiplied. And then the Lord raised up a leader, Moses. And then Moses took them out of Egypt because that was necessary. Moses mediated the law to them, a way of life, a culture. And then they wandered in the wilderness. There was a purging that took place. Moses is dead. But the next step, the Lord calls Moses, my servant is dead, and he calls Joshua to rise up. They go in, they invade the land, they come from the east, they split the land in half, then they conquer the north, the south, and then the north. And then they start settling the land in the book of Judges, a long, hard process where it looks like all the glory, I am going to make of you a nation, and it looks like it's all crumbling. But God is at work slowly, even through all this mess of immorality and idolatry. God is at work. He's got his godly remnant. He's preparing. And then he brings this Samuel, this young child dedicated to the Lord, and he judges all Israel all the days of his life, and we are beginning to see, coming out of all that chaos, we are beginning to see God's hand at work in the people of Israel. So the period of the monarchy begins.